Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the People Speak radio show. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson. The People Speak show normally airs every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. You can participate in the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the United States and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. That number again, 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government and politics section of PAL Talk to join in with your questions in a live chat online forum. This is a fantastic show tonight. We're talking to a very special guest here, a regular host on the long-running radio show called Surviving the Matrix. He's an Australian researcher, a documentary filmmaker, and renowned political commentator. We're talking tonight to Mr. Max Egan about the global awakening and about the New World Order and its implications for the people of Earth. Welcome to the People Speak radio show, Mr. Max.
Thanks for having me on, Steve. Pleasure to be here, brother.
Thank you, sir. We'll be taking some audience questions after the first half hour. But my first question to you, Mr. Max, is how long have you been digging into the New World Order agenda?
Oh, look, my whole life, it's kind of been a hobby for me. I managed to live on the outside of society for most of my life as a musician, and it gave me plenty of free time. So I got to travel a lot, and I was always interested in why the world was so messed up. And, you know, you start researching one thing and everything leads to another. I mean, I went down probably every rabbit hole you could find, you know, and it all came back to the fact that, hang on, why all these rabbit holes exist is because there's a massive cover-up going on. So obviously things are not the way we think, and it just became a, you know, a fascination for me. And then when 9/11 happened, like so many other people, I decided that it was actually time to start putting all the knowledge to use and speaking out about it, you know, warning people of what the impending future was.
You've personally produced a lot of fantastic documentaries that are out there online available already, including The Awakening, The Big Picture, Transformation, The Calling, New World Order, The Final Solution. All of these are available on your amazing website called thecrowhouse.com. Now, I have to say my personal favorite is Global Noncompliance. It pretty much sums up that we, the people, are partially responsible for our own slavery by tacit acceptance of this system. Is that primarily how you see the situation?
Well, yeah, that's a lot to it. I mean, it's our acceptance of it, but people don't realize what they're accepting. You know, people are just caught up within the wheels of the system. It's just, you know, it's like its own life force, you know, it's like it's got its own energy. Yeah, and we've actually created our own system by our training on what a successful life is, really. I mean, we go through an education system which trains us to be obedient and respect authority, and then we get taught that we need to enter into the workforce and create some company or enter into some business, and we want to strive for, you know, higher up the food chain within that business. This is called success. And the way you get higher up the food chain or make your business more successful is you reduce work costs, reduce labor costs, you reduce production costs, and you maximize profits. So essentially what you're doing is you're discarding more and more of humanity. You're making humanity work harder and harder to get a little piece of the pie, and you're making the system more efficient. And we can start a company and we can get it to a point where it becomes so efficient that it doesn't even need us anymore. And we see this with corporate takeovers of conglomerations and all sorts of stuff that happens. So this is what we've done, and in doing this, what we've done is we've constructed our own prison. We've been trained into believing this whole paper-based reality is what it's all about. We've been trained to think sociopathically, because this system itself, just because of those parameters, because you're constantly discarding humanity and making the system more efficient, this is psychopathic thinking. So we've been trained to operate within psychopathic parameters in the mistaken belief that it's leading to personal success. You know, but I mean, I know a lot of people that are quite well off. I know recently I've met bankers and all sorts of people who've gotten through this whole system, and they've got to this point where they own mega everything, you know, and there's nothing there. They own all this stuff, but there's no soul in it. There's nothing there for them. And they've realized that they've been sold a lie. The whole thing's been a lie. And now people are just caught up within this system, and they're believing the paper is real, and they're kind of waking up out of their stupor now and thinking, well, hang on, this is supposed to be about humanity. It's supposed to be about people. Why is it now so much about the economy? Why is it so much about making the system efficient? You know, we get fed this line by our governments that, you know, this particular politician's done a great job because he's done such a great thing for the economy. But all the people are in hardship, but we're told, no, no, we've got to have a strong economy because we need a strong, prosperous economy for the people. But in order to create this strong, prosperous economy, we have to constantly discard people along the way. So it cancels itself out. It doesn't make sense, you know. People are kind of waking up to this now, and they're beginning to, you know, question things. And so we're seeing our governments going to all sorts of lengths and all sorts of extremes to start really locking this system down, bringing in legislation right across the planet. You know, like the gag laws in Spain, the vaccination laws they want to bring in here, stuff they're bringing in New Zealand, stuff they're doing in France, stuff they're doing in the United States, England, it all ties together. It's all the one system. So, and they're doing it out of fear. There's a huge awakening on this planet. Someone you had on the show recently, Rebecca Roth, I've got so much respect for this lady and what she's done with this book. This has had a huge impact on people, more than you can possibly imagine, because there's all of these people who have never looked into conspiracy theories that are now being given this kind of a, you know, off-the-shelf adventure novel or, you know, murder mystery to read, and they're getting a massive truth bomb dumped on them in a way that you can't even debate it. So we're seeing all of this stuff coming out. We're seeing the true history of World War II coming out. There's so much stuff coming out now, Steve. So now they've got to lock the system down because this huge awakening is happening, and it's just going to get out of control for them if they can't keep people locked down very, very soon, you know.
A very good point you make is that people are still caught up in the trinket collecting and the distractions of our world. While we have so many other pressing issues to deal with, do you believe it's just that deep-set programming combined with cognitive dissonance, or maybe something else completely different, in your opinion?
Well, I think that it's from all levels, you know, cognitive dissonance for sure, but people are given a false version of what success is. They're given a false idea of what success is, so they're striving to achieve something which is a cloud. It's not real, you know, and they look at the world and they get frustrated, so they try to alleviate that pain and the frustration and the horror they feel at what's going on around them by just buying stuff and collecting trinkets and switching off to it. You know, if I bury my head in the sand, it'll go away. If just give me my TV and my, you know, remember the line in Network in 1975, you know, just give me my tea and my toaster oven, my microwave, and let the world go on without me. I'm safe here in my own little house. That's the way people have been trained to think, and that's the way they often deal with these problems. But, I mean, we're bombarded from so many levels, you know, just from the food that's fed to people in the supermarkets. Have a look at what's in this stuff. A lot of this stuff isn't fit for human consumption. The fluoride in the water, the electromagnetic bombardment, the digital waves that we're all swimming in now, the digital network that they've brought in, and this is an insidious network as well. They're using the digital network to be able to switch off areas and monitor areas all over the planet. Like, for example, they do raids in a local hippie town a few miles away from here called Nimbin, and they sort of regularly raid it and try to get the pot smokers out. And what they're doing now is they're shutting down the digital network for the whole area so that people can't warn anybody else that the police are in the area or any of that sort of stuff. So, and they can track you every 45 seconds from your mobile phone. If you've got a smartphone, an Android or anything like this, they track your movements every 45 seconds. You send off a satellite signal pulse, and they save that data for 7 years at least. So they can track your movements everywhere you've been with one of these phones every 45 seconds for the last 7 years. Or the next 7 years, and they can switch off any network in any area. This is why they've got towers. They've got so many towers in so many areas now because they can switch off these areas. They can triangulate areas, and they can switch off a certain area so they can perform certain actions, and no one can get any news out to anybody else because it's all on the digital network. You know, so there's so many ways we're being bombarded. Television is a huge one. I don't know what these digital things are doing to people. The set tops watch you. They've got TVs now that have got retinal scanning and can, you know, sense how many people are in the room and all sorts of stuff. You know, they sell to us as 3D TVs and all this sort of stuff. And these are all two-way things that can we can interact with all of this stuff, and they can interact with you. There's games have been put out now. They've been out for a couple of years where you can actually think and interact with the game by putting on a helmet and thinking. So don't think this doesn't work both ways. You know, they're putting all of this digital stuff and all this smart grid in place, and it's not very smart for us to be doing it. It's pretty smart for them, but it's not very smart for us. So, yeah, there's so many ways we are being affected, and people are waking up to the system, but they're seeing it, and they don't know what to do about it. That's the problem. It's just this big leviathan that they can't seem to get through. And what they can't get through is the fact that it's all fiction. It's a fictional reality. It's a paper-based reality. It's simply a matrix, you know. Our biggest problem, of course, is the brick wall of programming and, dare I say, stupidity in many cases and sociopathy in many cases that is our police forces now. Our police forces have very much changed in the last few years, and it's very difficult to address the political situation because you've got this brick wall of programming that protects the politicians. It's very difficult to even go and press charges against a politician because the police will just laugh at you and tell you to get out of the store, you know.
Apart from being a radio announcer and presenter, you're also many other things. You're a documentary maker. You're also an author, I believe. You've written a free PDF book entitled Earth's Forbidden Secrets. Can you give us a quick rundown what that's all about?
Well, that basically, I did that out of, I was in a pretty troubled emotional state, actually, when I wrote that book. I just had a major thing happen in my life, and I needed somewhere to go to get away from the world. So I thought, well, I'm going to put all my research on paper. I'm just going to put down, I'm going to write a book, and I'm going to put it out there. And the book was mainly an expose of ancient history, saying, look, there's so much stuff going on in the past. And I didn't attempt to explain any of it. I put forth a few hypotheses, but I didn't try to say that I've got the answer for anything. But I just said, look, there's all of this stuff lying around the planet that tells us that everything we've been told about our history is completely and utterly wrong. And, you know, if we'd stop looking at the microbes for a while and look up and look at all these big piles of stone that appear to be everywhere and all of these things that were built by these past civilizations, it becomes pretty obvious to you, you know, and out-of-place artifacts that have been found all around the place. So I was trying to point out to people that everything we've been told about our history is wrong. And so if they've lied to you about the past, what makes you think they're not lying to you about the present and lying to you about where we're going in the future? Some of the stuff that I touched on in the book, I actually disagree with now. Some of the findings that I had in the book, I was looking very much into the ancient situation in Sumeria and all of this Anunnaki research and all that sort of stuff. I've got very different views on some of that now to what I had back then when I wrote the book. But that's where my research was in 2005. And that actually caused me to start putting more of this into practice and looking at the more, you know, the political situation a bit deeper, and set me on the path that I am now. So that book was kind of a consolidation of my view of ancient history up to that point. I didn't really touch much on politics. I planned to do that in the second book, and I had the second book almost finished, and then I lost the hard drive and lost the whole thing. So that was a few years' work down the tube with that. But then I started thinking, well, look, you know, if you really want the second book, you just got to go back and listen to my radio shows and write it all down. And there it is. There's the second book, you know. And it's been a learning curve. The whole thing's been a learning curve. But that just basically, I put that out there just to say, look, everything you know is wrong. Everything they've taught you is wrong. And it's a very different world to what we believe it is. And if we can possibly understand our past, it might help us to understand our present a little bit better and be able to mold our future a little bit better, you know.
Absolutely. Now, back a few years ago, yourself and a personal friend of yours, Ken O'Keefe, you were both smuggled through the Rafah tunnels into Gaza, risking your life going into occupied Palestine to help the people. Did that experience change your life in any way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was an amazing experience. I look back on it, probably one of the more stupid things I've done in my life, but I absolutely treasure every minute of it. I'd do it again in a second. I really would. And it's important to understand this wasn't these Hamas smuggling tunnels or anything that you hear about. This was a tunnel that was dug by kids, basically, kids who want to play with their friends in Egypt. And they smuggled us through. They smuggled us through an area. Like, we got through this tunnel. It was like we were underground for like at least an hour and a half, crawling at least a mile. I don't know. It's hard to tell, you know, a kilometer or 2 kilometers, a mile. I don't know how long it was. We were underground for a really long time, crawling on our hands and knees. And it's a tiny little tunnel. Once you're in there, you can't really turn around and go back. You've got no choice but to go forward. So we were just in there for a really long time. We were brought up into this war zone, which is actually occupied by Islamic Jihad and militants that are not very friendly to foreigners. And they smuggled us through that little area, and we ended up getting into Gaza City safely and just hung out for 10 days. And when I got there, just walking on the ground in Gaza Strip, it's like hallowed ground. It really is. You know, ever since I was a kid, I was fascinated with the word Gaza because it was always in the news. Ever since I was a child, it was in the news. Gaza, Gaza, Gaza. You'd always hear about this war zone going on in Gaza, and I just couldn't understand it. And I just always wanted to go there. And when I got to England and I was with Ken, and I had an opportunity for us to actually get in. I mean, I was the one who suggested it to him. He hadn't had any thought of actually even going there at that particular time, and I was the one who kind of pushed for it. And he said, well, look, if you really want to and you're really serious about it, we might be able to organize something. And he contacted the right people, and we got in there, and it was amazing. It was a life-changing thing for me because I got to feel the energy of the place, and there's something very, very special about Gaza Strip. I can see why Israel wants it. I can see why the Palestinian people won't let go of it. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just the sheer will and the soul and the beauty of the Palestinian people that I felt when I was there, or maybe there's something even more ancient. I mean, Gaza is one of the oldest cities in the world that still exists. It's way, way old. So there's no concept that Palestine never exists. I mean, Gaza's been there for years, and these people lived in peace, and it's so abhorrent for what's going on there to be going on. And it's a population mainly of children. That's what really, really blew my mind when I got there. I came up out of the tunnel, and I looked around me, there's kids playing in the rubble everywhere and wandering around the streets. There's children living in shelters of rags. There's so many children and so many innocent people that are caught in this living hell that we could fix in a day if we simply paid attention. I mean, Gaza Strip is a war crime. It's a war crime of mammoth proportions. If you want to really get into it, get into the paper-based reality, well, let's look at some of the paper. Let's look at the Fourth Geneva Convention that says collective punishment is a war crime and that building settlements in occupied territory is a war crime. These are both war crimes. It's not a debatable point. Regardless of all the other stuff Israel does to these people, it's a war crime. And again, I see this as an opportunity to rein our own governments in under control. If we had united communities, we could just say to Tony Abbott's government, look, you're funding Israel, therefore you're supporting a war crime, therefore you're in breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention, you're in breach of human rights, we're taking you to the Hague, you and your whole government, everybody who supports this. You know, we could heal this in a day. We've got to stop looking at it as the Jews against the Muslims and the Palestinians against the Israelis. It's people against people. It's a humanitarian crisis. It's the greatest moral dilemma we've ever faced. And if we can view it as simply a humanitarian issue and step back into how humanity and deal with it from that perspective, we can heal the whole planet. We really can. Mm-hmm. If we can address this issue, we can change the direction things are going. But if we're going to allow this, well, look what else we're allowing. I mean, look at the state of this planet, Steve. It's absolutely ridiculous. Look what they're doing in Yemen. Look what they're doing in Syria. I mean, just what they're doing to the Palestinians in Yarmouk refugee camp at the moment. I mean, this is like the second Nakba. Now, 160,000 people been in that refugee camp since 1947. You've had 142,000 of them had to flee because of ISIS and al-Nusra Front invading Damascus through the refugee camp and just slaughtering the 18,000 Palestinians that are left in there. And all this is funded by the West. And there again, they're attacking Damascus, one of the oldest cities in the world. You know, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And all the West wanting to overthrow Syria, what's all this about? I mean, what are you going to replace Assad's government with? You haven't, al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda, one of these rebel groups? What is the tour? What are you going in there to replace this government with? If you're so unhappy with Assad, what have you got in mind for the country? Are you going to do what you did with Libya? Just turn it into another failed state? Go and remove the government and just leave it as a complete cesspit? I mean, that's what they're doing to the whole Middle East. It's an absolute joke, you know, and it's a humanitarian catastrophe of mammoth proportions. And, you know, Palestine is there for us to pay attention. These people have been putting their lives on the line for a very, very long time, and they will never, ever back down. Israel will have to kill every last Palestinian to get them to stop fighting. And they're trying to. They've been wanting to for a long time. And we need to pay attention to it. You know, it's an opportunity for us all to rein all of our rogue governments in. Now, you know, I think if we can just put humanity back into the equation, that's the answer to it all.
Now, not many people know it, but apart from being a legendary speaker, a web designer, and a filmmaker that you are, you're also a quite accomplished guitarist and musician. Do you feel being a multifaceted artist has given you the ability to see these perspectives that perhaps others don't see?
Look, I don't know about that. I mean, it's just right brain thinking, I guess. I mean, I was fortunate in as much as I found a way out of the system very early in my life. You know, I had a love for music. And I became reasonably accomplished at it, enough to be able to go and get employment. I always steered away from fame or fortune because I saw what it did to people. I just didn't want to participate in the system. I didn't want to be famous. I didn't particularly need a lot of money. I just didn't want to be part of the system. I wanted to just do what I want to do and be able to get some income when I needed it. And that's the way I lived. So I was kind of fortunate in that respect. But it's because when I was four and I couldn't understand the concept of land ownership. I couldn't understand why we had to buy a house. I couldn't understand why we couldn't just live anywhere. And I became fascinated at the world from that point. And so I just had that kind of a mind, I think. Music to me was a form of meditation and it was an escape from the system. Unfortunately, I used it very much as a bubble for a long time. You know, I was safe there. I was in my reality. Don't disturb me. I'm here. It works for me. I can look at this circus and this freak show that is the world and just not participate in it, but I'm safe in my little bubble. And then I had an event in around about 2005 or something when my music was basically taken from me and I lost my bubble. And I was forced to pursue my other love, which was my research. And that was really what set me on my path. I realized then that music, though it had been a great stress relief for me and it had been a safe way through the system, it was a distraction from what my true path was supposed to be, you know. I think that the world needs healing and that's what we're here to do. I think those people who are awake to the system have an opportunity to heal the system. And I started to think this way. You know, I got so stressed over my the loss of my music and my music collection in 2005 that the only other place I had to go was my research. So I sat down and wrote that book, and that sent me back onto the path of just concentrating on my research. So I started to realize that, hang on, this isn't just interesting. It's actually really important. And the fact that I've been given an opportunity to live my life on the outside of society and have enough free time to research all this stuff has put me in a really unique perspective. And I think that all of this has happened and this music has been taken from me at this particular time in my life in order for me to now put what I know into action. And so I see it as a blessing. I see that one of the greatest catastrophes of my life and one of the greatest losses of identity I ever suffered was one of the greatest gifts that was ever given to me.
When you said you steered away from being famous, that you didn't want to go down that path, is that primarily why we never saw your face for the first 5 or 6 years of your research and your documentaries? Nobody ever knew what you looked like?
Yeah, well, that's one of it. I wanted people to understand that I'm not doing what I do and I'm not speaking out and saying the things I do because I want fame or fortune. I'm saying it because it needs to be said. And I also had this idea that I could see the programming in people. And, you know, when you see someone on television and you get an idea of what they look like and you see lots of pictures of them, when you hear them speak, you associate that person with that voice. You know, you get an image of them in your head. But when you don't know what the person looks like and you're just hearing a voice speak in common layman's terms, not over-intellectualizing anything, just everyday words that people use, you don't have to go and get a dictionary to listen to any of my shows. The only image people can put over that is themselves. And so it helps them identify more with the words. They concentrate more on what's actually being said than on the persona behind it. Now people know what I look like. Very often they probably think of me when they hear my words, which is not what I intended. I didn't want it to be that way. I wanted people to just hear the truth that was in the words. And sometimes, hey, look, I don't always get it right with what I say. If you listen to the shows, you'll hear the growth through the shows. But I don't presume to get it right. I just offer an opinion. I offer my perspective on the knowledge that I've got, and I think a lot of it's pretty valid. And I think that I've helped a lot of people. I've got a lot of emails that say I have. But, yeah, I never wanted fame or fortune. I wanted people to just be able to hear the truth in the words and go on the journey with me. And if they were going to put any image to the conversation, to put their own image to it, you know. But I've never wanted fame. It's really weird, you know. Like I spent my life traveling as a musician and steered away from fame all my life. And then I stopped being a musician and all of this stuff. I stopped traveling for a long time. But I still had my music collection. And then when I moved to a small town in Australia, there was no employment in the town. So the only option I had was to put another band together. So I started playing again at about 45 years old or 40 years old and was doing that for about 10 years in that town. And but then I kind of just was doing that because I was sick of traveling. I was sick of playing in pubs. Just life of traveling. My life has been an endless succession of airports, you know. And I never wanted fame. I didn't want to travel anymore. And now I started speaking out. All I seem to be doing is traveling, and now everybody knows my face, and it wasn't what I intended at all. It's an interesting switch, you know.
Is it true or not that when you first started making your films and documentaries, you didn't think you had a good enough voice to narrate them, and you initially made these documentaries using a computer-generated voice? Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the big picture. When I made the big picture, I thought, well, no one's going to want to hear this ridiculous Australian accent and this ridiculous voice I've got, because I've never liked the sound of my own voice. So I don't know. I used to hear my voice on recordings and go, oh, my God, is that me? Oh, my God, why don't I sound like everybody else, you know? And, yeah, it's the programming, you know, the programming that we get. So I was part of the programming as much as anybody. So I just thought, well, people aren't going to want to hear my voice. So I released the big picture. I actually released it with an AI voice. There's a voice you can get. I think it's a British voice called Paul. I'm not sure. I don't know. It's a British voice, I think. And I released the video with that. And then about a month after I released it, someone recorded me talking at a gathering we kind of had in a small town, and was just part of a conversation where I was talking about the nature of the universe and stuff, my perspective of it anyway, and I ended up publishing it on YouTube. It was called In Lakesh, I Am Another Yourself. That was the first thing that I ever published online that had me actually speaking in it. And I got a massive emails from people going, oh my God, is this your voice, Max? I went, yeah. And they said, oh, you've got to redo the big picture with your voice. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. People don't want to hear it. And they said, no, you've got to do it with your voice. And I thought, oh, really? And they're going, yeah, you need to. So I did. I released it again with my voice, and then I released the other two films, and it just all went viral. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So, yeah, I never really planned on being here doing what I'm doing at all. But I think I was put in a position because of my musician lifestyle. I got to live on the outside of society. I always had this inquisitive mind since I was four. So obviously it all happened for a reason. And then once I got into a position where my voice was needed, I guess, I don't know, the universe works in mysterious ways, then everything, all attachments were taken from me. I lost complete attachment to all personal possessions. Any direction I had to go in to hide from what my path was taken from me. All I had left was my research. And so that's where I went. So I guess it all happens for a reason, you know. Even that the publishing of that In Lakesh, where people actually got to hear my voice, it all happens for a reason. And I guess I'm doing this because it needs to be done. So that's what I mean. I can do it without any ego or any. I really hate it when people say, oh, look, he's a celebrity or all this sort of stuff, because it's not about that. A lot of the reason I did it without putting my face out there was because I want people to understand that you don't have to be a celebrity. You don't have to be somebody important. We're all important. You don't have to be somebody, in inverted commas, to have a voice and to speak out. You just got to choose to do so. That's the point of the whole thing. It's not about fame, and it's not about being somebody famous. This celebrity programming is another program. It's a program that's put into us that we put people up on pedestals and we go, oh, yeah, what he said. Gee, I admire this person. I don't want you to admire me. Well, sure, you can admire me, but I want to inspire you to be you, to know you, to know the power that you've all got, because I'm nobody special. You know, I lived in a storm drain when I was a kid. I was just this musician for most of my life, living on the outside of society, not participating. I didn't even finish high school. You know, I left school halfway through grade 10. I didn't have any college education. I didn't do any of that sort of stuff. I educated myself and decided I wouldn't participate in society for about 30 years. So it isn't that I'm anybody special at all. We're all somebody special. If we can see a truth and we can see that there's a moral obligation to speak out for that truth, then I think we need to do so. Put down the fear. You know, this is just a temporary existence anyway. You're only here for a little while. And it's not about collecting stuff. It's about what you do with the perspective that you've got and what sort of energy you create, what you do with the information that comes to you, what you do with the choices between good and evil. They've got to be there. You've got to have evil. Otherwise, you don't have the choice to do good. So it's all there for a reason. Everything's for a reason. It's what you do with it, you know. And we're all special. We all have the capability of making this an incredibly beautiful planet if we choose to participate. But, you know, we've been trained to think we've got rulers and all of this rubbish. And, you know, it's all coming down, Steve. I think it is. I mean, and that's why they're doing what they're doing. They're freaking out that everybody's waking up to reality for the first time in, you know, this cycle of human existence anyway.
Now, you've been talking recently about giving up your radio show, the Surviving the Matrix. It's woken up so many people. You've been saying that you've said as much as you could on just about every topic, and you feel that there's not much left more to say. Do you really still feel that way?
Well, sometimes I just feel like I'm diluting the information, you know. I mean, I like coming on doing shows like this, but so, I mean, I want to make another film as well, and it's difficult doing the radio shows every week, and I mean, I've got someone that's helping me with the video editing at the moment, but it's difficult doing the seminars and the radio shows and the interviews and trying to make films and put Full Circle Project together. And I mean, I have so much on. I need three of me. It's ridiculous. I mean, I'd like to have a year off this show and make a film, because as soon as I started doing the shows, I kind of stopped making the films. You know, I managed to get one film out since I started doing the radio shows, which was Transformation, but that's one film that I've done since 2008. It's now 2015. I've got a lot of footage there from Peru. I've got a lot of stuff I really would like to put together into another feature film, but I'm simply not getting the time to do it. I've just got so much on. Even I had a month off about two months ago, and I ended up going speaking at Rainbow Serpent and speaking at another festival and doing about five or six interviews and a whole bunch of press TV slots and another seminar somewhere. I ended up having about 4 days off. So, and then I'm back on air again. So it's just finding the time to do things. And I don't want to dilute the message either. You know, I think I've said it. I mean, I don't know what else to say. You know, that the answer lies in the hearts of the people, and it lies in standing up and holding these criminals that are running our world accountable for their actions. We've got so many opportunities to hold our governments in abusive office under their own legislation, their own fiction. You know, all these governments are committing treason. Any government that's introducing anti-terror legislation, which has any effect at all of removing habeas corpus from the legal system, is treason. Habeas corpus is the basis of what we perceive our societies to be, what we perceive democracy to be. I mean, there is no real democracy. We won't even get into that. But, you know, the facade that they've got in place of what our social system is supposed to be is based on habeas corpus in the Magna Carta. Okay, so any removal of habeas corpus is treason. And people have to understand that we are the nation. The people of Australia are the nation of Australia. The people of America are the nation of America. They are the national identity. You remove the people, what have you got in the United States? You got nothing. You got land. It's just land. So it's the people that are the nation. Therefore, any threat to the people is a threat to national security. And any legislation the government is putting in place which removes from the people their ability to hold their government accountable for their actions is abuse of office, it's a threat to national security, and it's treason.
And it is.
And we've got, this is a crime against the nation that our governments are committing. This is not acceptable. How can the nation be secure if the people who are controlling their infrastructure are removed of accountability, and these people are carrying out war crimes? Exhibit A, Gaza Strip. Any government that is supporting this is supporting war crimes. If we were to stand up and call things for what they are and start using their own legal terminology, okay, you people, Tony Abbott, you need to show cause why the people of Australia should not hold you in abusive office and express a loss of confidence in your government's ability to govern and take the necessary steps to have you dismissed and replace your government with something a little more transparent so the people will see what's going on, so we will never allow this type of corruption to infiltrate into our government systems again. That's what the Australian people need to stand up and do. And that's what every government on the, every group of people in the planet needs to do. It's what the people in France need to do. It's what the people in Spain need to do, what the people in the United States need to do. We all need to stand up and call this for what it is. And if we're going to abide by their fiction, the fiction they make us abide by, well, we'll use their fiction against themselves, and we'll call abuse of office, we'll express a loss of confidence, and we'll work for dismissal under their own system. We have the ability to do it, and we have every opportunity that's been given to us on a silver platter to simply stand up and do it. If we could somehow unite our communities and get them to see sense on this matter, help them, you know, get them to stop squabbling amongst each other. That's a lot of what all this is about. We're squabbling over the size of our front doors and what sort of car we drive, you know, what team we barrack for.
Okay, big question now. What's your personal opinion about 9/11? Did 19 Muslim hijackers with box cutters do that?
It's a joke. I mean, the concept that 19 hijackers with plastic box cutters carried out the 9/11 attacks is absolutely ludicrous. Of course, 10 of those people are still alive that are in the process. They've been trying to sue the FBI for a long time to get their names taken off the website and off the sheets that depict them as the hijackers. They're still alive, 10 of these people. The official story is completely and utterly ludicrous. You know, 9/11's got Israeli fingerprints all over it. elements from Israel that work within the United States government. It's got their fingerprints all over it, and it's obvious to anybody who looks at it. The official story, I don't know how anybody bought into that, and it stands as a great testament to the effects of fluoride, I guess, and television, what people can be taught to believe. It defies all rational analysis that anybody bought into that official story. It's a joke.
Absolutely. So in your mind, it was Mossad, was it Larry Silverstein, Dick Cheney, PNAC, or was it all the above?
All the above. The military-industrial complex and the Zionist influence within it. There were large Israeli influences in it. If you look at what we were talking about before, Rebecca Roth's book, you look at the Promise Software, all the companies that were involved, and you look at the benefits to Israel from the 9/11 attacks. You know, everything that's happened since 9/11 is everything Israel wanted to happen in the Middle East. It all points directly towards the Greater Israel Project, Oded Yunus' plan for Greater Israel. You know, the strategy for Israel in the 1980s that was put forth in the document by Oded Yunus. Everything that we've done in the Middle East strongly supports the Greater Israel Project. Nothing that America is doing seems to benefit the American people, and all American foreign policy seems to be directed at supporting the Greater Israel Project, all American foreign policy in the Middle East anyway. And when you look at the Middle East and you look at what's going on there, you got homeless tent cities springing up in the United States. America is so in debt, it's ridiculous. And to the tune of you know, the debt to China alone exceeds the gross national product of the entire country. Just the interest on the debt exceeds the gross national product of everything in the United States. And still funding Israel to the tune of $7 million a day. All this money is being funneled into the Middle East. Look at Afghanistan. They funneled $104 billion into Afghanistan since 2003. Recently, we heard they'd misplaced $43 billion. If you add it all up, they've actually misplaced $62 billion since they started funneling all that money in there. They can only account for $38 billion of it. So since this happened on September 11th, we've had at least $62 billion funneled into just Afghanistan alone, not to mention all the other countries. And all of this whole terror groups have all sprung up through the Middle East, and there's been this massive destabilization program going on in the Middle East because you've got all of these Zionists within the U.S. government which are controlling foreign policy and milking the assets and the wealth out of the United States and funneling it into the Middle East to fund all these terror groups, and they're pushing all the weapons they can in there as well. And it's all creating this huge destabilization and balkanization of the Middle East, which is all supporting the Greater Israel Project. And this is all a result of the 9/11 attacks. So, yeah, who benefits? Cui bono. Have a look at the Arab world.
We're back, and you're listening to the People Speak radio show coming to you live across America and across the world. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our special guest tonight. He's a political analyst for Press TV and an accomplished documentary maker who has given speeches across the world, from the Hemp Congress in Slovenia to the town halls of the UK and even to the jungles of Peru. Welcome back there, Max.
Thanks for having me back, Steve. Nice to be here.
Anytime. We've got a couple of questions from the audience here tonight. Is it true that the ASIO, the Australian Security Intelligence Organization, this is a question from Jane in California, is it true that the ASIO Act to indefinitely hold people's emails and their metadata that was passed without one vote being cast against it?
I'm not sure whether there was one vote being cast against it or not, but it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, everyone's trying to operate within this system. Everyone sees they want to get everybody. They're scared. You know, what they're doing here, all this metadata is about, and what the militarization of the police is about, all of this stuff, it isn't about protecting your rights at all. It isn't about protecting society. It's about protecting the politicians against you. And it wouldn't surprise me if it passed with no vote, because these politicians know that they're all criminals. I mean, let's face it, like I said before the break about Palestine, any politician that's supporting this is a criminal. Let's face it. And if we rally the people and we want to start pointing out the criminals in the political system, it's going to be all of them. So it wouldn't surprise me if they passed it without a vote. Without a vote against it, it wouldn't surprise me at all. But I don't know for sure. I haven't heard.
Now, here on the People Speak radio show, we get live call-in questions, and we do have a question online. Mr. Rock, Cash, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Hello, Steve. How are you? Hello, Max.
Hey, how are you, Rock?
Great. My question to you is, what are your thoughts of the gun laws in Australia? We know they disarmed you guys pretty much except for weapons that can only fire a single shot or a double barrel hunting weapon, but that's about it.
Yeah, that's about it. They did that to us. Well, you know, they did that to us a long time ago. I mean, we weren't a very, very gun-like nation anyway. I don't agree with it. I didn't think it was a good thing to do because there wasn't a lot of gun crime to begin with, and the whole Port Arthur massacre that they used to do, it was so obviously staged. It was obviously set up by the government. I would suggest that there was also an Israeli influence in that. But I don't think that there would have been any solution militarily for Australia anyway, although maybe now with what our police are looking like. But no, I didn't agree with it, and they're really pushing forward in the United States. It's imperative that the people of the United States do not give up their firearms. But I would hate to see it erupt into anything like an armed confrontation or civil war anyway, because I think the people would be vastly outnumbered against some of the military hardware that we see. So as much as I don't agree with it, I don't see it as a solution anyway. I still see the solution as being an empowered community simply standing up and calling things for what they are. I think if we're honest in what we do, there's still enough politicians within the system that may not be psychopaths like the guys at the top that will see the sense of what we're saying. And I'm quite happy to forgive people that have worked within the system. I don't think there's any armed way out of this anyway. It'll be horrible if it comes to that, you know.
Well, hopefully our military, you know, will see what's going on and put a stop to it themselves.
So, yeah, you know, it's a worry. You guys have really got some stuff going on there at the moment with Jade Helm and the closing down of these Walmarts, and there's so much going on there that you guys have got to be concerned about. And the great hope there, of course, is, like you say, that the military and the National Guard and all these people will not turn against their own citizens when it all comes down to the wire. But with the financial state of the United States at the moment and the bill to China and some of the things that China's got planned in the future, I even question the name of this operation, Jade Helm, what this has to do with the debt to China, the timing of it all ending in mid-September, right before the Chinese are due to possibly announce that they would like to take over as the global reserve currency, because the United States can't really do it anymore. The United States national debt far exceeds the gross national product of the country. You could sell every single resource in the United States and all the water, every blade of grass, and every person to the highest bidder, and you still wouldn't pay off America's loan to China. So China's in a position to do that, and if China does do that and it forecloses on its debt, it'll see the collapse of the entire Western capitalist system. And that's due to happen September 10th. They're due to announce it. I don't know whether the United States will be able to, you know, avoid this. I mean, they might find a way of ramping up a few more wars, start a war with Russia, which is what they're trying to do. So they might yet find a way to extend it a little bit past that point, but I think that's where it's heading. I think, you know, the Western economic system all rides on the back of the US dollar, which is essentially worth nothing. The only thing that's holding it up is the fact that it's the global reserve currency, and the whole world is suffering the effects of this, including the EU, everything, and even the wars in the Middle East. I mean, the entire world is suffering the effects of the US dollar being the global reserve currency, and if we were to put a stop to that, it would certainly alleviate a lot of the problems of the world, but it would create an enormous amount of difficulty for Western societies. We'd suddenly find all of our dollars are worth nothing. And if that situation comes to pass in September this year, well, you can see why they've got Jade Helm all in place and they've got the Walmart set up as the command centers. And they're running it in Yemen as well. Actually, the U.S. military has taken over the command centers in Yemen at the moment as well, and they're running them. I mean, the Walmarts in Yemen, they're using them as military command centers, because Walmarts are set up to be military command centers. So basically, you've got a military post in every town that you've got a Walmart. They're set up to be this. So everything's in place for them to prepare for this impending crash in September, if it happens, if China decides to float this new currency, or however it's going to do it. I don't know if it's going to be a new currency or whether it's just going to take over the global reserve or whatever. But I know a lot of the bankers that I know are talking about, this is basically what the whole banking community is talking about, is what China may do in September and they're all talking about how the crash is going to happen, not if it's going to happen, just how it's going to happen and when it's going to happen. They all know it's going to happen. And this relates to a lot of stuff, even with all these people talking about the Dragon family pulling the finances and all this sort of stuff, and this will be a great thing when they pull the money out from the elite. They don't understand when China pulls the money out from the elite, this means a complete crash of the entire capitalist system. This means you get up in the morning, you go to the bank and it's closed, and you go to spend the dollars in your wallet at the store and they're worth nothing. So this could be the way it's going. And in that situation, anything. It's a wild card. Anything could happen from that situation. So we're in for a very interesting year. I mean, that's just pure speculation on my part, everything I gave you. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but all the pieces are in place for that to happen. And when you look at the fact that they seem to be running a test case for this in Yemen right now, and Operation Jade Helm and the closing of these Walmarts, you gotta wonder.
Yeah, definitely been wondering. Well, thanks for your answer.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Rock. Well, we do have a question from Bill in New Jersey. What does Max think of the terror attack in Sydney at the Lindt Cafe? What are your thoughts on that, Max?
Well, they did a drill for that a year before at the same place. I have friends who were in Martin Place the night before who say there was a heavy police presence in Martin Place the night before, even though it was ghost town, there was nobody there, and they already had one street barricaded off the night before. When they set it up to look like an ISIS in Australia type thing, a Muslim extremist. This guy who did it was a nut job who wasn't even, he was, the whole Muslim community denounced this guy as an idiot. He had nothing to do with Islam. And I wonder if he was even in there. They probably just took him in there and shot him. I mean, it appears quite apparent that the people who were killed in the attack were actually shot by the police when they went in there. They just went in and started opening fire. And regardless of whatever the collateral damage was, there's every indication they were killed by the police. The gunman didn't kill anybody. It was probably just some guy in a beard they put in there. They probably arrested this guy the night before and then just took him in there and shot him. Wouldn't surprise me. I think the whole thing was a setup. I don't think it was anything like what they've told us, which is why everybody involved has gag orders on them. Nobody's allowed to talk to the press.
Now, not many people know this, but you are also a stage and set worker for the movie Dark City, starring Kiefer Sutherland and William Hurt. A very cool movie. What was that experience like?
Well, I didn't even know what the movie was at the time. I spent a lot of time working on film sets. I worked on lots and lots of films. It was just like another job. I mean, I was just building a film set. I didn't really get to read the script of that one. I knew it was just a film called Dark City. I didn't know what it was about, and it was a particularly interesting sets to build. We had to build these sets that could be moved, and there were lots of special effects in it, so it was good fun. But I didn't really know what the script was about at the time. It wasn't until someone sent me the movie years later. I went, oh, Dark City, I remember working on that. And they went, oh, my God, this is like a cult movie. And I thought, well, I didn't even know that. So, yeah, interesting.
We have a question from Larry in Nevada. Is it true that Australia is forcing sterilization on people with disabilities, like the article in The Guardian says?
Yeah, they have been doing this for a while. Forced sterilization, it's not really seen as forced sterilization. It's, they're just getting, people to consent to things that they shouldn't really be consenting to. It's kind of this, social trap that we have with benefits and all sorts of stuff in this country. This is the way they're doing it with the forced vaccinations that they're bringing in as well. You can't really say this is forced medication, but you do have a choice. You can give up all your benefits and go out and become homeless and starve. We don't care. So, you can't really say it's forced vaccination because you're given a choice. It's the same sort of thing with this. They've got young girls under the age of 12 consenting to be sterilized and all sorts of stuff as well, and consenting to mental treatment and all sorts of stuff just by tricking them. In Western Australia, there's all sorts of legislation that's been brought in to this effect. I mean, Western Australia is pretty amazing. Western Australia is leading the world in police states at the moment, I think.
Absolutely. Now, many people have speculated and would like to know, have you ever worked for the CIA?
Oh, yeah. What? No, I've never worked for the CIA. I've never worked for anybody except movie companies and rock and roll bands, basically.
Excellent.
Yeah, the only straight job I ever had was building film sets, and that's really not a straight job. But most of my life, I've just been a musician and worked for myself. I've never worked for any government departments. I've never had anything to do with government. I've kept as steered clear of them as I possibly can.
One last question. Do you, Max Egan, support the stop funding of Israel?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think Israel is carrying out massive war crimes and human rights violations, and it's all being funded by Western governments. We need to pull funding from it immediately and address the situation in Palestine. As I said earlier, it's the greatest moral dilemma that we face.
Well, you've been listening to the People Speak radio show with special guest tonight, Max Egan. I'd like to thank him very much and remind all the listeners to visit his website at www.thecrowhouse.com or listen to him on his regular radio show called Surviving the Matrix, while it lasts. Thanks very much for being on the show today, Max.
My pleasure, Steve. Anytime, brother. Happy to come on and do another one anytime you want.
Wonderful. It's been great to have you. Join us up coming next month with the People Speak show when I talk to the former Black Panther activist and political researcher Larry Pinkney. Stay tuned for that one. Big thanks go out to the producers Mike and Donald, to all my friends in the Pal Talk room, and all the guys who have given me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Take care.
Write some-